weekend, every weekend, on C-SPAN 3.
In 1972, the Saratoga National Historical Park in New York hired archaeologist Dean Snow to conduct excavations at the Revolutionary War battlefield. Next, Penn State anthropology professor emeritus Dean Snow talks about his findings at the National Historical Park and how the archaeology work inspired his book, 1777, Tipping Point at Saratoga. The New York Military Affairs Symposium hosted this 90-minute event.
Dean R. Snow's previous books include Archaeology of Native North America and another book called The Iroquois, but in all 20 books, I believe. He's known for his research into paleodemography of prehistoric populations. His New York research included major projects on the Saratoga battlefield and in the Lake George region and in the Mohawk Valley. Snow moved to Pennsylvania State University in 1995, where he served as head of the Department of Anthropology for the next 10 years. In 2005, he was a fellow at Dumbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C., before returning to Penn State as professor of anthropology. He served as president of the Society for American Archaeology from 2007 to 2009. He has also been closely involved with the development of Digital Antiquity, a cyber infrastructure program for the archiving of archaeological data initiated with funding from the Andrew Mellon Foundation. Dr. Snow lives in University Park, Pennsylvania, with his wife of 52 years, Nan Snow. And we should note, Dr. Snow is accompanied here in New York City tonight by their daughter, who you may recognize as NBC correspondent and weekend NBC nightly news anchor Kate Snow. So NIMAS welcomes Dr. Dean Snow.
Oh, thank you very much, Bob. I'm delighted to be here tonight, and hope that I can get through this quickly so we can get to the question period, because I find that to be the most entertaining for me part of any presentation. I thought I'd talk to you tonight about a number of things that I think would be of particular interest to people in this organization. Was that somebody at the printers didn't have anything to do with the people here that produced the book in New York City, but at the printer somebody apparently forgot to include the URL of the companion website that goes with the book. And I have some cards up here that have this web address on them. If you're interested in looking at that, please come get one of those cards. And back behind there are some additional copies of the card. But I'm eager for people to look at the website, because there are things there that are too expensive to put in any print version of a book. There are color maps, for example, and the maps are interactive. If you're interested in the battles at Saratoga, you can see where the troops were hour by hour on the 2 days of fighting, in addition to the day following the second battle, and 10 days later when British were surrounded in the little village of Saratoga, which is now called Schuylerville. And I don't want anybody to miss being able to access that. And since it's not in the book, you wouldn't be able to find out about it otherwise. I wanted to talk tonight about a few specific subjects. How the book came to be written, particularly how it came to be written the way it was. Battlefield archaeology generally, and my experience there as an archaeologist, how this book is different, and how the armies were organized, and some supplementary materials that I thought might be of interest to you. And then finally, a little discussion of the role of the militia, because the militia was very important in the American Revolution. How I got involved at Saratoga began with a phone call from this gentleman. This is John Cotter, who at the time was a senior archaeologist in the Park Service, had his office in Philadelphia, and in 1972 called me and said, "We really need you to help us out. We are getting ready for the American Bicentennial, and we're a little concerned about the Saratoga battlefield because we're not absolutely convinced that they have put the interpretive signs exactly where they ought to be, and we don't want anyone to be misled about the nature of these battles." I was in my early 30s at the time, so when he presented me with the notion that I should do the archaeology of an area that is over 5 square miles in size, and he was going to give me $2,500 to do this, I thought, why not? When you're 32 years old, that kind of request is seen as a challenge rather than the impossible task that anybody with more sense would have thought it to be. So here's what the battlefield looks like today. The white boundary line is the modern, or the current boundary. Back in the 1970s, the park was slightly smaller, but it's pretty much the same as you see it now. What they were interested in finding out more about was the location of the British fortifications and the location, secondarily, of where the American lines were in 1777. We had the benefit on the British side of some maps drawn by a British officer named William Wilkinson. He had the job of going around in the period between the two battles, when there was no fighting going on of any major, at any major scale, but during which there was an awful lot of skirmishing going on, pickets being captured by patrols from both armies, desertions going on from time to time as people deserted the British Army and came over to the American side for the most part. His map is really very, very useful to us, and you can see over here, over here, major construction of British fortifications at this far end of the British line. The right end, from our perspective, or the left flank of the line, was resting on the Hudson River. A mile or two away, off the bottom of this screen, were the American lines. And they were, in effect, the mirror image of the British lines for the 32 days that there were people on this battlefield. Okay. The archaeological objectives then were to explore the redoubts that the British had built, one called the Balcarres, the other called the Bremen. These are their major fortifications. In 1973, a year later, they gave us a new contract. We explored the Great Redoubt, and I'll come back to that, and we'll talk about what it was. The location of a house, or the remains of it, called the Taylor House. Some exploration of the American lines, and then the following year, we looked more at the American lines and also went back to some of the central British fortifications. The archaeological techniques that I would use if I were to go back and do this kind of a project now would be these. Half of them weren't available in 1971. We had maps from 1777. We were able to find airline service that would fly low-level aerial photographs so we could do very, very precise and very extreme topographic maps. We had a magnetometer, but it was brand new technology. You couldn't buy a magnetometer in 1971, but you could rent one from the company that was developing it. Soil samplers and metal detector were also available, but resistivity survey was not applicable in this situation. Ground penetrating radar, nobody knew what that was. It hadn't been invented yet. Portable computers, give me a break. Nobody had a portable computer in 1971. Electronic surveying didn't exist. GPS, everybody has that in their cars now. It wasn't even dreamed of in 1971. So, what I had was an enthusiastic bunch of students. There was a lot more hair in those days. This guy with the black hair is me. Colors have changed in those years too. A number of these students went on to have careers in archaeology. One became a park ranger, another ended up working in the New York State Museum. My first doctoral student, this guy, went on to have a significant career in teaching at SUNY Oneonta, and so on. So a number of these young people did very well in the years following. So that was my crew. All right, now let's take a look at the personae that were involved with the battle. We jumped one. Here we go. I don't know what happened to Horatio, but he's not there. Let's try that again, see if he pops up. John Burgoyne on the left was a British commander at Saratoga. It was his idea that he hatched out in 1775 while he was involved with the siege of Boston, Battle of Bunker Hill, and the events in eastern Massachusetts that were part of the early stages of this war. He conceived of the notion of driving south from Montreal and having other British troops move north from New York City, converging on Albany. And the idea was to split the New England colonies off from the other colonies, to separate the New Englanders from the New Yorkers and the Pennsylvanians and the other people farther south. The idea was that the hotbed of the revolution was in New England, and if they could just keep those New Englanders from influencing the rest of the colonials, maybe the loyalists in New York City and farther south would be able to be recruited to the British cause more effectively. So it was a good idea. It was one shared by a number of others in the British Army, and it was the notion that Burgoyne was able to sell in London and then came back in 1777 to put it into effect. Horatio Gates, whose picture the program chooses not to, I can see it up here on my screen, but you can't, was a former British officer. He and Burgoyne had been in the same outfit when they were young men, when they were lieutenants. And they had known each other in England. They were both part of what was then the finest army in the world. And Gates had later realized that he didn't have much of a future in the British Army because he could not afford to buy the commission that would enable him to move up in the ranks. If you were a British soldier in those days, you had to buy a commission. You didn't get there by merit. You got there by negotiating and by getting financial backing from someone. In the case of Burgoyne, that financial backing came from what was originally a reluctant father-in-law. But once his wife had a baby girl, the father-in-law changed his attitude about this guy's worth. He was known as Gentleman Johnny for a reason. He had a gambling habit, and he liked to party. He had to sell his commission early on in order to get money to live on. So it gives you some idea of what the terms of enlistment were in the British Army. There were other people involved at Saratoga that I should mention. Here are two of them. Thaddeus Kosciuszko was a Polish military man who had engineering experience and a lot of talent. He came over, like a lot of European nobles did at that time, presented himself to George Washington and said, "I'd like to help out." Well, there were a number of these people who did this, Lafayette being the most famous of them. Some of them very successful, Lafayette certainly was. But there were others who were basically just adventurers looking for an interesting diversion out here in America. There was one with Gates that I might have time to talk about later. But Kosciuszko turned out to be talented and very serious. And Washington said, well, all right, you're on. he didn't say you're hired because he didn't have anything to pay the guy, but he agreed to let Kosciuszko help out the American army, and Kosciuszko then assigned to the Northern Army under the command of Gates, came up to New York, and eventually all the way up the Hudson to the Albany area, and it was he that chose the location for the American lines up north of Albany. It was he that decided that where that Northern Army was going to make its stand was the right place to do it. It was the best ground. We also had Benedict Arnold, who at the time was very ambitious and had done fairly well. He had had a disastrous attempt on Canada. We don't have time to talk about that tonight, but he had also proven himself worthy on Lake Champlain. So it was well thought of at the time. Washington particularly liked Benedict Arnold as an officer. But Arnold had a narcissistic personality. He's the kind of person who would step into the vacuum anytime there was a lull in the conversation. He always had an opinion. He was sometimes wrong, but he was never in doubt. And this eventually got him into a lot of trouble, as we'll see. There are other books about Saratoga. Here are two really very good ones. I recommend them to you. These are books about the campaign. So they start in Canada, they finish up in Saratoga County, but they cover the whole campaign, and they cover it in detail. And because they cover it in that fashion, they are like most general history books. I've just finished one on Antietam, for example. Told at 30,000 feet. They're very, very abstract from the point of view of the people who are actually on the ground doing the fighting. They're very good books, but they're not the book that I was interested in writing. I thought I was going to do a book that involved the archaeology as much as the history, because the archaeology is what I was familiar with. That was what I was intending to do 3 years ago when I finally had the time to turn to writing the book that resulted from my work way back in the 1970s. But it turned out that another book was being prepared, and they asked me to write a chapter on the archaeology of the British fortifications, which is mostly what I had done at Saratoga back in the 70s. And I agreed, partly because it freed me from having to include too much archaeology. That's kind of a crazy thing for an archaeologist to say, I suppose, but that's how it worked out. So I have a chapter in this book, which came out earlier this year. It covers the archaeology and made it unnecessary for me to do that again in my own book. Another thing that happened was I had been reading and rereading this book for years. I discovered it decades ago, and it is Michael Shero's book on Gettysburg. I live not far from Gettysburg now. It's a fascinating place. I love it like a lot of Americans do. It's a great place to visit. This book really tells you that story in a beautiful way, in an intimate, personal kind of way. And I thought, that sounds to me like the way to write a history book. But this is historical fiction. So it's the book that Ted Turner chose when he decided he wanted to do a movie on Gettysburg. This was the basis for the Gettysburg movie, which a lot of people have seen. If you go to Gettysburg, watch that movie the night before you go, and it makes it a much better experience when you get there. So this had a big, this is my personal copy. You can see that it's pretty dog-eared. And I pull it off the shelf every once in a while and open it up just at random. And just read a few pages. It's that good. You can read any part of it just for a little while, and it's a very entertaining experience. The other thing that happened to me was that I was invited with my wife to a little garden party in May of 1995, and it was a goodbye party. It was a going-away party that a couple of friends threw for us, and they invited two other couples. So there were eight of us at this party. Charlie and his wife and the women were off someplace else, and the other two guys that were there were these two men. Now this is Rudolf Moët's picture from the Schenectady Gazette. That's the best picture I could find from it. This is his obituary photograph. But I did find this picture of Fred Sawada online. I had the experience of spending 20 minutes or a half hour standing there with a glass of wine in my hand while these two guys discovered that they had fought each other in World War II. Dr. Mowe had lived down the street from me for a quarter of a century, and I knew him slightly, but I just assumed that he had come over to the United States before the Second World War, that he was one of those guys that had got out of Germany before things got bad. There was another local doctor that I had used, professionally, I'd gone to him as a patient, who was that kind of German expatriate. He had escaped from Germany, came here, and set up a practice. This guy, however, had been drafted into the German army and had been sent to the Russian front. This man, Fred Sawada, whose real name was Hiroshi Sawada, had grown up in Hawaii. And he and his brother both volunteered for the 100th Battalion of the Army Reserves in Honolulu. And when the war broke out, he, of course, was activated. This whole battalion was. And the battalion was sent to Europe, where it was merged with the 442nd. And the 442nd, of course, was the Nisei, or Japanese-American unit, that was so important in saving a lot of American lives during the Battle of the Bulge. These guys had both ended up in the Po Valley of northern Italy. Fred was there as the American troops pushed north in Italy. Rudolf was there because the Russian front had collapsed and they were pulled back and reassigned to northern Italy. And as I stood there, I discovered these guys had actually fought each other. Now, the thing about that conversation was that these men talked about the experience as if they had been both at the same football game. It's as if, you know, I was there last Saturday night when Penn State beat Ohio State, all right? And it's the kind of conversation that I might have with an Ohio State fan a year or two from now about that game. It was an amazing conversation. I've never experienced anything quite like it. These guys talked about their experience in World War II the way the World War II vets that I knew growing up out in the prairies of southern Minnesota talked about their experience. And the older they got, the more forthcoming they seemed to be. The sharp edges of the horrible experience these guys both went through in Italy had been blunted over the years. And now they were talking about it as if it had been a soccer match or a football game, something like it was an amazing conversation. He talked about being a doctor in the German army and working to keep the men in his care from being further wounded by evacuating them when the Russians got too close. This guy talked about what it was like to be an American soldier, and he turned to me and said, "You know, the German army was really very good. You know, well, the Ohio State football team is very good too. They lost, but they're a very good team." And what amazed me was that later I found out more about these guys. What Rudolf didn't tell me was that he won two Iron Crosses for bravery, saving the wounded men in his care. What Fred didn't tell me was that he was wounded four times on four separate occasions. And he talked about being pinned down one day. This was his example of how good the German army was. He said, "I was in this open field in a kind of a low area. I was pinned down. I couldn't move. I had to stay there all day and into darkness so that I could get off the field without being shot by the machine gun nest over on the other side of the field." What he didn't tell me was that he earned the Silver Star for that that day. And if you read the citation, you find out there was a lot more to it than him just being pinned down for 6 hours. That's a Purple Heart. Probably should have four more of them someplace, or three more. Remarkable men, and I thought, if I'm going to write this book on Saratoga, I want to write it like these guys would talk about their experience in World War II. I want it to be personal and intimate. I want people to understand what it was like for those guys that were out there, and it turns out there were some women too, even in the revolution, who were out there getting shot at. And that's why the book has the appearance that it does. It's not a traditional history book. It's the way an archaeologist might tell the story. We tend to be detail people. An archaeologist can spend a whole summer digging in an area the size of this room, and we think that that's the big view, you know. All right, so enough of that. I wanted to also point out to you how the armies were organized so that I don't use terms that that will confuse. The Northern Army, the American Army, had two divisions at the beginning, and each division had three or four brigades to start. Each brigade was made up of a few regiments, and these, of course, were divided up into companies and then the individual soldiers. So other terms that were added later that you will hear in sort of the military history of the United States Army were pretty much not developed yet. These were the basic. This was the basic vocabulary of how the Army of the United States was organized at that time. Remember that the Army was only 2 years old in 1777. It had been formed out of a bunch of crack militia group units that had been regiments that had been fighting around Boston. That was the core of the Continental Army as it was created in the summer of 1775, and a day later they appointed George Washington as commander in chief. The other thing we should note is that during the Revolution, the words regiment and battalion were used almost interchangeably. It took me a long time to figure out why that was. It's like figuring out where they put the pickles in the grocery store. You know, it turns out that regiment is an administrative term, whereas the battalion is an operational term. So you can have regiments that operate as battalions that might be referred to as battalions when the fighting is going on. But there are also units that are assembled from pieces of regiments that were then called exclusively battalions. They would never be called regiments. So, for example, in the British Army, they had 10 companies per regiment. And two of those were flank companies. One would be grenadiers and the other light infantry. And it was customary for generals to detach the grenadier units from the regiments that had them and put them together into grenadier battalions. They then would also take the light infantry companies out of the regiments and put them together in a separate battalion. All right, so we'll be coming back to that. Here's how the Army of Canada was organized. And another point that I should make here is that there were structural deficiencies in the way the British were doing things that made it very difficult for them to do their business. There were brigadier generals here, but these were all guys that previously had the rank of colonel. And they were elevated just for this expedition to the rank of brigadier general so that they could have commanders for the brigades. This seemed to make sense at the time, but it meant that, for example, over here, Burgoyne's second in command, Major General William Phillips, was a major general here at Saratoga, but he was, I think, a lieutenant colonel in the artillery and in the British Army, and in the artillery, he was a major. So there was this confusion of terms when it came to rank. You didn't know really who you were dealing with half the time. And it meant that another problem was that if Burgoyne had been successful and if he had linked up with the British troops here in New York City at Albany, then General Howe would have taken over overall command and all these temporary ranks would have been vacated and these guys would have gone back to being colonels or even lieutenant colonels. So it was a structural deficiency in the way in which the British conducted their management of the ranks. The Northern Army of General Gates was divided into two divisions at the beginning, and Arnold's left division was under the command of Major General Benedict Arnold. Gates's Wright Division was one that he chose to manage himself until such time as Benjamin Lincoln arrived, because Benjamin Lincoln was also a major general, and the idea was that when he finally came in to camp, he would take over this division, and Gates would then be the overall commander. They were all major generals, but they, of course, were subordinate to one another in terms of the time and line, so that Arnold had fewer days of service than Gates. And, in fact, it was one of the things that he was annoyed about. Congress had done this to him, he thought unfairly. And when Benjamin Lincoln arrived, Arnold was going to be a subordinate to him simply because he had not accumulated as much service at rank as Lincoln had. This was one of the problems, structural problems on the American side. Arnold's division included Morgan's Corps of Riflemen, a brigade commanded by Brigadier General Poor, and another one by Brigadier General Learned. On the other side, the other division, commanded by Gates until the arrival of Lincoln, had Patterson's Brigade, Nixon's Brigade, and Glover's Brigade. And Glover's Brigade turns out to be really important. John Glover came from Marblehead, Massachusetts. His men were largely mariners. It was Glover and his men that got George Washington across the Delaware River to attack Trenton. They knew which end of the boat went first, which was not necessarily the case for these other troops. All right, so here we are. This is the Eastern American lines as they were laid out by Kosciusko. And you can see that they sort of roughly reflect the mirror image of the British lines, which I showed you before. What Kosciusko figured out was that these bluffs here, if they were fortified and if we moved all of our cannons, all our artillery onto those bluffs, it would make it impossible for Burgoyne to push down the river road. There's swampy ground here. The road angles away from the river and right towards those bluffs. So by putting the American guns up here, he made the British advance along the river road virtually impossible. And as a consequence, when the first battle broke out on September 19th, the British troops swung to the interior. The advance corps was right here, was commanded by Simon Fraser. They went farthest inland, stopped about here. Hamilton's British division swung on some woods trails to there, and Riedesel, the German commander, the commander of the German troops that were here, some Hessians, but mostly Brunswickers. Brunswick is an English name. The English couldn't pronounce Braunschweig. So Riedesel stayed down here by the river. The Americans moved their riflemen up here and the light infantry under Dearborn over here initially. And Gates said, fine, we'll do that. These are Arnold's men, all right? But what happened next was what became problematic between Gates and Arnold. Arnold started sending more units out. And Gates said, you're leaving the American lines undefended. I want to fight a defensive battle behind these lines down here. Arnold was saying, well, wait a minute. Those lines aren't even complete. They're not even complete over here. They could turn our flank. They're good. This is a really good army. You don't want to leave this flank open down here. We've got to meet them out here on Freeman's Farm. Gates kept objecting. Arnold kept sending units from his division forward anyway. Arnold even went and recruited volunteers from units that he didn't command. And because of his personality, a lot of these guys said, sure, I'll go along. This resulted in Gates getting more and more angry about what was happening. Here is Freeman's Farm. at about 11 in the morning on this 19th of September. You can see that the farm is not a very big clearing, and the clearing is still today as it was then. The British are about to come out of these woods up here. Morgan, with his riflemen, was the first out there. He had been told by Gates, just harass the British Army as it advances. Don't get engaged here. We want you to, do what you can to harass them. Morgan's men didn't have harassment in mind. They had their rifles loaded, and they moved out here amongst these trees. They moved up here and took over the Freeman farmhouse, and then waited. Major Forbes came out of the woods with skirmishers. Morgan moved up into this position, and a firefight started. Now, the difference here was that the skirmishers, the British skirmishers, were armed with muskets. They were light infantrymen, and they were very good, but they had muskets, and they weren't accustomed to aiming at anything. The British technique was to mass musketry and to have everybody hold their barrels parallel, level, and fire massive volleys. They didn't even pull the gun up to aim down the barrel. They would shoot with the butt of the musket here against the shoulder, held down this way. The idea was to be precise, to keep the guns level, the muskets all had to be level, and so on. The Americans were hunters. When they fired, they aimed first, especially the riflemen. Now, the problem with the rifles was they weren't designed for military combat. The Morgan's riflemen would need about 2 minutes minimum to load a rifle with one shot. A musketeer could load and fire in 15 seconds, and then another 15 seconds he'd be ready to fire another shot. Wildly, perhaps, but he was ready. The riflemen were very, very precise. Some of these men could hit a pie plate at 100 yards with these weapons. So when Forbes came out on the field, he found himself suddenly without men because they were being picked off so rapidly that he had to retreat very quickly. But they were being picked off by riflemen who now had empty rifles and needed time to reload. So when the British main units came out of the woods, the riflemen scattered. Morgan thought he was done. Now, I'm showing you these because this is the stuff that's on that website. These maps are in the book, too, but they're black and white in the book. On the website, you can really see the detail as we work through the course of the afternoon of September 19th. So here are some more. Eventually, under Burgoyne's orders, these American units move up. Gates is apoplectic. You're sending up too many units. Stop sending so many units forward. We're going to lose too many men. The 2nd New Hampshire joined the 1st and the 3rd New Hampshire. Cook's militia from Connecticut moved up. Morgan gathered his men, and they got up into these trees over here. Then the British started to advance across Freeman's Farm, especially the central regiment, this one, the 62nd Foot. Morgan's job, as he saw it, was to pick off the officers. This was regarded as unsportsmanlike by the British officer corps, but it was very effective. As the afternoon dragged on, they went back and forth across this field seven times. Every time the British advanced, they would push the Americans down into these woods. Their technique was to push forward volley after volley, and then, after firing one last volley, they'd run a bayonet charge. This was their favorite tactic. The problem was the New Hampshire men would just simply fall back into the woods, and the woods prevented the bayonet charge from being effective. Now the British have exhausted their bayonet charge, and they've got empty muskets. All they can do is start retreating back again. The Americans, meanwhile, in the woods, have reloaded, and they push out, and they end up going back this way. The artillery that the British had brought along were taken by the Americans and then retaken by the British over and over again. The Americans would have carried those guns off, except all the horses were dead. And they didn't have any horses down here to bring the artillery off. So this is how the afternoon ended. We're down to about 5:30 now. It's going to start getting dark. Finally, General Riedesel, down by the river, sends a couple of regiments over, and these guys appear and attack from the American right flank. And that is how it ends. Between the two battles, the British moved into these positions. So here we have the right flank of the British line, which is secured by something called the Bremen Redoubt, and down here a fortification called the Balcarres Redoubt, which is where I spent a lot of my time investigating British construction techniques. The other regiments are scattered down this way, and then we have the Great Redoubt over here where the concentration of administrative stuff was. The Americans, for their part, went back to their lines on the south side of the battlefield. Technically, that meant Burgoyne could claim a victory because he held the ground that he had fought over that day. Between the two battles, Arnold and Gates have towering arguments. Gates basically tells Arnold, "You have no business here. You're out of it. I'm not going to use you anymore." Those of you who use a lot of computers will recognize that when something's grayed out like that, it's not available anymore. He never really dismissed Arnold. He never officially dismissed Arnold or cashiered him or anything. He gave him a pass to go to Philadelphia because Arnold requested one, but Arnold never left. But neither did he have a command. So here we see that Horatio Gates is the commander of the left division now. Benjamin Lincoln appears, finally, and takes over the right division that Gates used to have for himself. And look what else happens between the battles. Militia units come in, especially from Albany, but also from Connecticut and New Hampshire and so on. The American army is swelling very rapidly. Lincoln's right division also gets additional units. Some of them militia. Here we have Walcott's brigade, one of the most heavily administered brigades ever. We have a brigadier general, we have all kinds of officers, and we've got maybe a couple hundred men, tops. There's enough officers in this brigade to run about five regiments, but they have only 200 men or so. This is one of the problems with militia. The other militiamen were saying, I'd really like to help out, but I don't think I can make it this weekend. That's how the militias operated at the time, which is why the general staff didn't like using militia. A lot of them would not use militia units if they could avoid it. All right, that brings me to the next topic, the death of Simon Fraser, which is likely to be the most controversial part of my book. Fraser was mortally wounded at about 3:30 in the afternoon on October 7th in the heat of the second battle at Saratoga. This was the tipping point. If Saratoga was the tipping point of the Revolution, inside the battles of Saratoga, this was the tipping point of the second battle. This was the moment at which the German and the British troops under Burgoyne's command broke. It was also the case that although they were the finest army in the world at the time, they were completely unprepared for what was about to come at them. The Americans were without uniforms, poorly armed, practically untrained, but there were 15,000 of them. And they were upset. So, that was the difference. Simon Fraser was an excellent general. He was from a long line of military men from Scotland, and he fell where this monument now stands, and I'm pretty sure that the monument is properly positioned. This is where he was shot. He was on horseback. He was shot, however, by an Albany militiaman, not by Timothy Murphy. And anybody who reads any of the books that have been written up to now about the Saratoga battles will be told that you will read that the guy that shot Simon Fraser was Timothy Murphy. It turns out, however, that nobody attributed the shot to Timothy Murphy until long after Murphy's death. In about 1845, a local historian named Jephthah Sims published a book in which he said Murphy was the guy that shot Simon Fraser. This is despite the fact that there had been an eyewitness account already published in the Saratoga newspaper by an artilleryman who said, I was standing next to an old guy from one of the Albany militia units. He shot Simon Fraser. I saw him do it. And Simon Fraser then was hauled off to the Taylor House, not the British Hospital, which some sources say was where he was taken. And he died the next morning, and he was buried on a bluff inside the Great Redoubt area over by the Hudson River. But it wasn't the southern bluff, it was the middle bluff. And he was disinterred prior to October 17th, probably by treasure hunters, but certainly not by the Fraser family. I have checked twice with the Fraser family. Nobody ever came from the family to disinter his remains and take them back to Scotland for reburial. So these are all popular myths about Simon Fraser, and there are people who believe these myths who aren't going to like what I said in the book, but I'll stand by what I said. The Balcarres Redoubt was built between the battles. You saw this same map earlier where the first battle took place. And when Simon Fraser fell and his line broke, the men fled back mostly to here in large numbers. So this redoubt, this fortification, was overmanned. At the same time, the next redoubt, which is north of here, was severely undermanned because the troops fled to the closest sanctuary. They didn't go back necessarily to where they had been deployed from to begin with. Fraser is on his way back to the British lines at that point. This is about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. What happens next is that the Americans come here very disorganized, but very enthusiastic, and start attacking the Balcarres Redoubt. And here we see them moving across this low, wet ground out here. They swept over this little outlying fortification very quickly and easily, but then they came up against the main line of the Balcarres Redoubt, which is where I did much of my work in 1972. This is what it looks like today. This picture was actually taken in 1971, when the Park Service still had what they thought was a good imitation of what Freeman's farmhouse probably looked like. But nobody knows what his farmhouse looked like, and they decided that rather than have an incorrect reconstruction, they shouldn't have any at all, so they removed it. This is what happened at 4 p.m. on that day when the Americans assailed that position. And you can see that there are a lot of British troops up there behind the redoubt walls defending their position, and you can see a large number of Americans here with Benedict Arnold on a big brown horse charging around in their midst. We even know the name of the horse, by the way. What's wrong with this picture is that the artist has shown, and this is on the cover of the book, but what's wrong with it is that the artist has shown these guys in blue coats. We didn't have uniforms yet at this point. They were wearing whatever they happened to have. Some of them had old uniforms left over from the French and Indian War. Some of them had hunting clothes on. Others of them were just catch as catch can as far as clothing goes. All right, so there's again the Balcarres Redoubt, this time from the map that Wilkinson drew at that time. And here's my crew excavating the wall of that redoubt to try to find out what kind of construction the British had done there, and to ensure that the Park Service was actually interpreting it correctly. Anybody that's done any gardening knows that 2 feet of topsoil doesn't occur in this part of the world naturally. That was heaped up topsoil. It's still there. Here's some stones that were thrown into a vertical post that was put there to try to anchor that post. The British soldiers did this between the battles. Here's another one. Another post was put here with some stones to keep it upright. And there's a woodchuck burrow there too, but that's that is a 1971 woodchuck burrow. Here's what we found. We found a trench. And we picked it up through all these excavation squares. Down here, we didn't find the trench. What we found were post holes instead. So it looks like they had an entry point there, a place where the troops could go in and out of the fortification, a sally port, they would call that. And later, I decided that this line was the probable location of the top of the parapet on the outside of that trench. I was misled, however, by the park historian at the time. He said I should expect to find the trench on the outside of the fortification, not on the inside. And this had a crucial effect on my interpretation initially. Here's what we expected to find because of what I was told, but this is the kind of structure you would build if you were trying to build a fort at that in that era that you expected to use for several years. These guys knew they were only going to be there for a week or two. The ditch on the outside of the fortification, with the glasses here to provide a firing a plane for the men standing back here, didn't exist. What we found instead was the ditch was on the inside. All right, here's the difference. This is to scale now. So if we have a musketeer behind the parapet and he's in a permanent fort, this is a very good position for him to be in. Down here we see, however, that you get the same kind of protection if you put a foot trench here and a parapet here. But I cheated a little bit. These are not really to scale, are they? So if we do this, you'll see that they were able to get much more bang for their buck. We're only going to be here for a couple of weeks. We want a fortification that we can do quickly and easily that will be effective. So we have a foot trench and we have a parapet here, and it's much less earth moving than would have been necessary to do something like this. Okay, so it wasn't permanent, it was a temporary fortification. Now, we dug this section up here, which you saw blown up a few minutes ago, and then we put in some other trenches down here to see if we could pick up the fortification there as well. We had here the remains of some excavation that was done by another archaeologist in 1941 that we worked into the overall interpretation. But down here, we found a burial. First thing we found was a femur. This is the knee joint down here. This is the back of a femur. And that meant that if this was, we didn't know if we just had a femur, a thigh bone, or if we had a complete burial. So we knew that we're going to have to do something with this because this was the very spot where the Park Service had determined they were going to put a little rest stop on the hiking trail. They were going to have benches here. They were going to dig holes. They were going to do all kinds of. So, all right, we've got to find out what we've got. So we opened up a big area to excavate. And since these kids were doing this for college credit, so the ones that found the burial were joined by all the other ones who would watch, and then they would take turns. I wanted them to all get the experience of doing this kind of excavation. And the way you do this archaeologically is it's like the floor of an elevator going down. You take the dirt away without disturbing the burial. And here we are working down on this burial until we finally get it exposed. And I made my inferences about it. The first shock I had was when I called my buddy, the biological anthropologist, to come out and help me with this. What was his initial assessment? He said, "What do you think this is?" And I said, "I think this is an American soldier that was killed in the assault on Balcarres Redoubt because he was in the trench." And I was still thinking that the ditch was on the outside of the redoubt because that's what the historian told me to expect. He said, We can be pretty certain it was a battle casualty. Not to get into the details here, but she was shot in the face, and we had the clear evidence of what had happened to this person on October 7th. But Dick pointed out, this individual was at least 60 years old, and quite possibly as old as I am now, and I'm no spring chicken. I thought it was in the outside ditch, I thought it was male, I thought it was American, and I was wrong. It was on an inside ditch, I later discovered, because we found this burial early in the process. It wasn't male, and it wasn't American. What on earth was this little old lady doing out there? She was, at the time she died, about 5 feet tall, at least 60 years old, and she was a battle casualty at Saratoga. What is going on here? Well, that dragged me deeper and deeper into the historical record, and that was what fueled my interest in this sort of personal approach to what had happened on that battlefield. It turns out that there were over 200 women with the British Army. They were largely the wives of British non-commissioned officers. And they were there with their husbands. They marched south from Montreal along with their husbands. And when this battle became really desperate on the afternoon of October 7th, I think that a lot of these women were inside the Balcarres Redoubt, frantically loading muskets and handing them forward to the men, who would fire them and hand them back. This made them more efficient. The women were helping out. And she just happened to look over the parapet at the worst possible moment and died. So we learn from our mistakes. In 1972, I thought it was a battle casualty, and I was right about that. I was right about the age. I was right about the date it happened. But I was wrong about it being in an outside ditch. I was wrong about it being male, and I was wrong about it being an American. It was almost certainly a female British wife of one of the non-commissioned officers. When she died, instantly, she fell into that foot trench, face first. They didn't move her, and they didn't strip her clothes. We found her buttons. At that time, typically, officers would be buried in single graves if they were found dead on the battlefield, but enlisted men would be put in group graves and would be stripped of their clothing. The clothing was very valuable, and they stripped most of it. There was one American guy who was wounded in one of these battles, came staggering back into camp, stark naked. He had been shot in the head. He had been unconscious for a long time. He woke up, and he had been stripped of his clothing. The poor guy had to make his way back to the American lines stark naked. It happened. Okay, the other redoubt, the Bremen Redoubt, was to the north. And this was the right flank of the British line. This was where Arnold, in the second battle, exhibited his heroism. We did a good job for the Park Service because they had this thing put in the wrong place. They also had the Arnold Monument in the wrong place, and so we got that fixed. And you can see why. They were working from this map, and we were working from the archaeology. We found the main redoubt line archaeologically. We were able to describe it in detail. We excavated sections of it to make sure we knew exactly where it was. And we found the place where the Canadians had been positioned. They ran for it. They were way outnumbered. So they left. This left this backside of this redoubt area open. There was a 400-meter gap between these two redoubts that was left unprotected by the British, essentially. And the Americans took advantage of it and swept in behind, right about here, and where is he? There's Dearborn's light infantry came up behind Arnold. Arnold was shot right about here through the femur. The same shot apparently killed his horse. Henry Dearborn rushed up, and he and some men tried to roll the dead horse off of his good leg, which was pinned under it. A young American soldier decided he was going to shoot the German soldier that had shot Benedict Arnold. Arnold said, don't hurt him. He was just doing his duty. And so the soldier desisted. The man was taken prisoner. Arnold then said to Henry Dearborn, I wish that it had passed my heart. How would we view this man today if that had happened? He was the hero of this battle. Everyone knew it. Gates had to chew on his tongue because Arnold had been insubordinate in being out here at all. He didn't have a command. And Gates had somebody chasing him through the whole afternoon to try to get him to come back to headquarters. And this guy's name was Armstrong, and I know one of his descendants. And I said, you know, your ancestor worked really hard that day, but Arnold had a faster horse. Anyway, here's the monument that was put up to Arnold, and it's still there. You can visit it. It's the famous boot monument. He wasn't shot in his lower leg, however. He was shot in the thigh. So the boot's a little inappropriate, but they had to do something. And if you look here, this is the inscription on that monument. He was desperately wounded here, winning for his countrymen a decisive battle in the American Revolution, and for himself the rank of Major General. So that it never mentions him by name, and it misses the fact that he already had his rank of Major General at this point. This isn't something that he earned by being brave at Saratoga. Okay. Couple more things here. These John Fairling's favorite myths, seven of them, and one of these myths is that the Saratoga was a war's turning point. I do think that it was an important turning point. You only know things in history from the benefit of hindsight, and it has to be well-informed hindsight. And at the time things are happening, you're not going to have the same perspective as you will 20 years later on. At the end of these two battles, the British officers were saying to each other, we're not going to win this thing. It is time for us to go home. The war lasted another 6 years. But the people who were involved at the time saw it for what it was. Because of Saratoga, the French came in on our side. Because of Saratoga, we got uniforms, we got training, we got weapons. All kinds of things happened that enabled America to win that war. The other one I want to concentrate on, though, is that the militia was useless. Now, the militia was problematic. But let's talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of the militia in that war. What was good about it was there's a long tradition of this. There had been militia units all over New England especially, but all throughout the colonies for a long time. The best New England regiments had been turned into the Continental Army in 1775. They were committed. And they eventually evolved into what we call the National Guard now. What was bad about the militia was that it was what scientists call an emergent phenomenon. It was self-organizing. Hey, guys, I think we should have a militia unit here. What do you think? Men would get together and create militia units, called regiments, usually. But the enlistments were short-term, the regiments were local, and thus they tended to be parochial. The men regarded orders to be suggestions or requests. They often thought that they should be able to elect their officers and to replace them promptly if they gave orders that the men didn't like. And so they regarded the service to be kind of ad hoc and situational. This is why the generals didn't like militia regiments. Not because they were cowards or would flee at the first opportunity, but because they were organizationally hard to deal with. The ugly was that they were poorly equipped. They didn't have firearms that amounted to much. And they didn't have uniforms, tents, and supplies. They were poorly trained. They were, as Burgoyne called them, rabble in arms. And this is the title that Kenneth Roberts used for his book. Here are the militia units of Connecticut, which I like to use as an example. This is how they were in the middle 1700s, and as the war got closer, they became more and more numerous. They were turned into brigades, grouped into brigades. John Latimer's and Thaddeus Cook's two militia units served very well at Saratoga. And these, well, we won't spend any time on that. Those have been recently described in great detail. The other thing that happened was that the mounted men in these militia units were pulled out and formed into five separate militia regiments of cavalry, light horse, in Connecticut. And my ancestor belonged to one of those. So the myth that they were useless is not true. They were not a jot less serviceable, according to Burgoyne himself. They could be cranky and insubordinate. They had other obligations. They all wanted to go home and bring in the crop. But they were very effective at Saratoga. Without them, we would not have won that battle. So thank you very much. I would like to thank especially my wife and my kids, friends and colleagues, and Oxford University Press, which has had enough faith in me to publish my book. Oh, and here's a pretty picture. Yeah.
Thank you. The Battle of Saratoga in Europe is often called the Battle of Bemis Heights. I've actually seen it that way. So, yeah. But my question is, if that's true, then all these battles on the flank were unnecessary and were not in any way decisive. I mean, even if they had succeeded, they'd have just come up against Bemis Heights fortification.
That's certainly true for the Battle of Bemis Heights. The first battle, which was fought a couple of weeks earlier, is usually called the Battle of Freeman's Farm. And at that time, the American fortifications, were not yet complete. And I think that Arnold was probably right, and the other generals agreed with him. It was Gates that was reluctant to send the men forward to fight out in no man's land. He wanted to make it a defensive battle. But I think that Arnold and the other generals were correct that the left flank was insufficiently protected, and they could have been flanked pretty easily by the British if the British had really struck hard on that first day. But it took them until noon to get themselves organized, and that was part of the problem.
Well, my question would be, if that was true, if it was the Battle of Bemis Heights, then Kosciuszko would get the credit for winning the battle, and it would have given time for the militia to show up, and mass has a quality all its own. So quantity has a quality all its own, and I think Gates anticipated that it was just a matter of time before the militia piled on, which would make Arnold not only insubordinate, but in this sense, incompetent.
Well, you could make that argument. We could spend a lot of time talking about that. Thanks.
Very much. Two questions. After Saratoga, did people ask, what size of an army the British would need to win in the colonies? And secondly, you mentioned the deserters, especially from the British Army. I presume they tended to be German, so that there was even a focus on the weakness of that particular unit.
They lost a lot of men over time. As they moved south, they got weaker. They went beyond their supply lines. They weren't able to supply themselves effectively after they crossed the river. And there was no way to reinforce their units. They did get some reinforcements, but not enough. And at the same time, the Americans were getting stronger and stronger and had very little difficulty bringing supplies up. Now, during the first battle on the 19th of September, only Gates knew that all they had for powder and shot was what the men were carrying. He knew that. He was waiting for new wagon loads of shot and powder to arrive from Albany. Hadn't got there yet. And he was thinking, what if Burgoyne renews the attack tomorrow? So that was part of the reason he was holding a lot of men back. The whole right division saw almost no action in the first battle. But that meant that those men still had shot and powder. The guys that did most of the fighting on that first battle, they didn't realize it either, that when they got back to camp, they weren't going to find powder and shot to to restock their pouches. So it was a, kind of a near thing. And actually, one of the arguments that Arnold and Gates had was over that point. Arnold said, why didn't you tell me that we were almost out of ammunition? And Gates said, basically, what difference would it have made? It was better that I carry that burden myself rather than get everybody else concerned. And as it turned out, within a couple of days, all the powder and shot they needed arrived from Albany.
When I was a kid, one of the things we learned about the Battle of Saratoga was what occurred shortly before, that when Burgoyne was coming down from Canada, the Indian allies had attacked a farmhouse or whatever and killed a young woman.
Yes.
And that incensed the militia. The whole countryside erupted, and those militia units that you are probably the ones that came down to join up with Gates, et cetera. The second thing is an Army captain who fought in Vietnam wrote two books, one was the most important military leaders of all time, and the other one was important battles of all time. Now, he had, and I know a lot of people disagree with this, but he had, including Tom Fleming, he had, you said the myths of Washington as a great, as the winner of the... He had Washington as the greatest military leader of all time because, most important, I should say, because that was the, he helped create the, because of the victory, he helped create what the United States was able to come into being. Mm-hmm. And the second one was the Yorktown as being the most influential battle. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about those things. Thank you.
Well, of course, Yorktown was the end of the war. Lord North got the news from the Yorktown, and he said, oh, it's over. That's it. We're done. The British leadership in London finally recognized that they had lost this one. Yorktown was the last straw. That was the second time in British history that an entire British army surrendered. Saratoga was the first time that an entire British army had laid down its arms and surrendered. Now, they didn't call it a surrender. Burgoyne wanted it to be called a convention. And, you know, and Gates's attitude was, call it mashed potatoes, doesn't matter. As soon as you've put your muskets in a pile, you're mine. And he was right about that.
Washington and also the girl being killed.
Well, Jane McCrae was her name. And this was a propaganda coup that fell into Gates's lap that was just terrific. For him. And the newspapers, you know, we had a lot of newspapers then, and they would get news from the battlefield and have it in the papers the next day in 1777. It's true. It was amazing. So the Albany papers were full of this stuff. And Gates realized he had a propaganda coup on his hands, even though Jane McCrae was a loyalist. She was engaged to be married to a British officer. She was trying to make her way to the British officers' quarters over on the Hudson, and it was the job of a couple of Burgoyne's Indian allies to get her there. They got into an argument about who was going to get credit for delivering her, and one of them killed her because he didn't want the other guy to get the credit. This didn't work out so well for Burgoyne because even though she was a loyalist, it incensed the American public. So it didn't matter that she was a loyalist. She was blonde and beautiful, and these guys killed her. You know, that was enough.
And Washington as the winner of the
revolution. Well, yeah. And Washington was very good at not losing. I mean, That's one thing you have to remember about him. You know, he was fighting to not lose much of the time. Have the microphone?
It's me, yeah.
Oh yeah, there you are.
Yeah. Why do you suppose, other than the fact that his name is so difficult to pronounce, Kosciuszko's contribution to the revolution in general is so consistently undervalued?
Well, I don't think it's undervalued in upstate New York. But I think your point would be that he just hasn't received the attention he deserves, probably in the history books. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I find him to be a kind of a sad figure for other reasons. You know, he went back to Europe, and he really, really wanted Poland to have independence, and this was the beginning of a dark period for Poland. And, you know, the poor guy struggled. He tried to have the success in Europe that he had over here, and it didn't work out for him.
He got the order for Cincinnati, of course. That meant something back in
the day.
Yeah. Nobody knows about his failures over there, the general failures of Polish freedom. So why would he... But both of these last few years around the value, but Kosciuszko especially.
He deserves more than he got. Yeah.
Thank you for a great presentation.
Thank you.
And good luck with the book. I tried to find it in Barnes & Noble today, but it's not on the shelf yet, and the public library doesn't have it, so I'm glad you brought copies.
Okay.
I've been to the battlefield. I've seen Arnold's Monument. I've war gamed the battle. Most of the units you have are in my miniatures collection, so you really did an excellent job. You'll get another invitation real soon. Two things. One, you mentioned Arnold's Monument and where it was located. Were you involved in locating that? And the other point was, Saratoga is the battle, and really two battles usually laid out, but it's also the campaign. Before this happened, before the Saratoga battle, there was the action at Bennington, and I saw that it was mentioned in your index, and I don't want to...
Yeah, it's in the book. I didn't have time to mention it tonight.
If you say a word about Bennington, because I've got relatives who live up there, and but also talk about a little bit about locating Arnold's Monument, too.
My ancestor, who was at Saratoga... was in the Connecticut Light Horse, and he liked it up there so much that he moved to the Bennington area and lived just half a mile from the New York State Bennington Monument Park. Burgoyne sent an expedition, detached them from his main expedition, sent them to Bennington because he thought they could get some horses and supplies there. He had 2,000 horses, and it wasn't enough. His dragoons were unmounted, despite the fact that he had 2,000 horses. He had five or six of his own, so that if he had one shot out from under him, he would have a fresh one to ride. A horse requires 20 pounds of forage a day. The Americans were denying forage from the British Army. You run the numbers. 2,000 horses, each one needs 20 pounds of grass a day. And the Americans aren't letting you graze your horses. The horses were dying. The oxen were dying. He was pulling an enormous artillery train because he thought he was going to have to lay siege to Albany. So, you know, things were not going his way. Bennington turned out awfully because John Stark was over there with his militia. And these guys were Vermonters. Vermont had just declared itself a state, by the way. It wasn't yet accepted into the United States. It was a 14th state, but it was, in effect, in 1777, it was an independent little country. Stark said, I'm not going to submit to being ordered around by the commanding general of the Northern Army. If you want me to do something like that, you got to make me a brigadier general, and Congress hadn't done that yet. Eventually they did, and by the time of the surrender, Stark did bring his men in to help with the final surrounding of what is now Schuylerville. Bennington had a huge effect because it drained him of some of his men, and he lost a lot of men there, either killed or captured. He lost the entire expedition. He lost two cannons. And so forth. And some of his men went over to try to save these guys, got wounded, and came back injured. So there were a lot of problems with that Bennington expedition. It was a major blow to his effort.
And locating Arnold.
I just told the Park Service, you know, you've got that over there on that hill. That's not where it belongs. That hill was overrun by the Americans very quickly. It was never a point of fighting because the German troops that were in it went back to the main fortification. I said, you really should think about moving it. And so they did, and they decided where to move it to, which is pretty close to where he was wounded.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting details in your book is you have a lot on what food Burgoyne brought with him, and but also again how like the price of food that and that's a problem for him. So I just wonder, is that just historical sources, memoirs, and whatever records the British had, or is there any archaeological information
of his prodigious supplies?
Yeah.
We know where the where he put his headquarters because the, it was littered with wine bottles and champagne bottles. He had a huge supply of wine and champagne, and he had the assistance of the wife of one of the commissaries. He enjoyed playing cards all night long, and he enjoyed the company of women. He enjoyed gambling with his senior officers, especially if they were of noble blood. He was himself illegitimate, and his biological father had arranged for him to get an inheritance, which is what he used to buy his first commission. But then he blew it gambling and had to resign his commission and sell the commission in order to have food to live on for in the early part of his career.
Yeah, and second, a lot of historians argue, well, after Bemis Heights, Burgoyne's only option was to then at that point burn his baggage and make a run for it back to Canada. So I wonder if you agree with them that he could have escaped that way, or was he just screwed?
If he had made the decision earlier, he might have been able to get back to Canada. But this army that he had was this clanking, cumbersome army that moved 1-2 miles a day on a good day. And the Americans were very good at dropping trees over the only road to Canada. And the Americans were very good at burning every bridge before he got to them. So every day for him coming south involved clearing away trees so that he could drag this huge artillery train down the road. And because the oxen can't climb over trees, men had to clear these trails. And he had to... I'm losing my thought here. He had to also ford streams because the bridges had all been burned, or he had to have crews out there rebuilding bridges. So often he had soldiers that were building bridges and then twice as many soldiers there to protect them so that the Americans couldn't pick them off as they were rebuilding bridges. It was, you know, a huge logistical chore for him. And the Americans knew how to make it hard.
I've been to the battlefield several times over the years, and it's a confusing battlefield, even for someone who is familiar with both the battles, because if you take the auto tour, it swerves back and forth between the two. And so you end up being quite confused by the sequence of events. Yeah. And unless you're able to say, oh, this is the Bemis Heights battle portion that I've driven into, or the Freeman's Farm portion I've driven into, it's very hard even for someone versed with the battle to keep track of it. I would imagine most average visitors are quite confused by it. But the point I wanted to make was a few details about the initial engagement you had between Morgan and Fraser's avant-garde at Freeman's Farm. Morgan's men, he did pick off a lot of the pickets that Fraser had. And then they rashly charged out into the open, Morgan's men, unloaded rifles without bayonets.
No bayonets.
And they came slammed into the Earl Balcarres' light infantry battalion, who shredded them with several volleys.
Yep.
And they were thrown back in complete disorder and probably would have been chased off the battlefield had not Dearborn's light infantry, who had been sent forward specifically to support them and had bayonets, were able to protect them and enabled them to rally.
Well, that's almost the case. That it turns out that Dearborn saw men off to his left, and he was afraid they were going to fall on Morgan's flank. So he went he didn't follow up on Morgan to give him direct support. He went farther west in order to prevent a flanking attack from that direction. So part of the reason that Morgan's men got dispersed was that Dearborn wasn't there to support them. But Dearborn had made a hard choice. I could take you out there and show you where Dearborn's men were and where Morgan's men were, but they were too far apart. And that's why Morgan, at one point, according to Wilkinson, now Wilkinson might have been lying because he was a liar, but he, according to Wilkinson, Morgan was in tears. He said, "I'm ruined. My men are scattered," and that's the famous incident where he uses his turkey call to reassemble them. We got them back together, and then, of course, they participated later in the battle, and everything worked out. But you're right. The riflemen were badly abused by the British troops in the opening.
My second point briefly would be, do you think if Howe had cooperated instead of going off on his own to Philadelphia and brought the bulk of the army up to Albany, would Burgoyne have been able to successfully link with him at Albany, and do you think that would have had decisive impact for the revolution in 1777?
It might have. It might have. You never know. I mean, you can't run the experiment. But if Howe had stayed in New York, and if all those men had been available to go up the Hudson, at least two of the three pincers would have been able to join forces at Albany. And by the way, as far as traveling the or touring the battlefield go, when I take friends out there and show them the battlefield, I try to do it twice. I say, okay, we're going to look at the first battle, and then we go around a second time to do the second battle. The problem is, of course, that both battles were fought on the same ground, and the Park Service tries to interpret both of them at the same time, and it's very confusing. Very, very confusing. How much time do we have, Bob?
I have two questions.
Okay.
Okay, two questions. First of all, General Dearborn, is he the same person who founded Fort Dearborn or Dearborn, Michigan? Or
yes.
Is that...
He was a major at Saratoga, and he had a military career after that. Rose the rank of general and fought in the War of 1812.
Okay.
And he named his son Alexander Scammell Dearborn. And Alexander Scammell was one of the regimental commanders from New Hampshire that everybody loved. And he's in the book. And his girlfriend's name was Nabby Bishop. And he kept writing letters to Abby saying, "I want to get married in the worst way, but we have to fight this war first." And he was killed at Yorktown.
And the second person, this Wilkinson or Wilkerson?
Wilkinson.
Wilkinson. The name sounded familiar. And when you mentioned, well, he might have lied, is he the same Wilkinson who met Aaron Burr on the expedition to Montreal and they established a long relationship? Which culminated in the attempt to detach part of the United States, part of the southwestern states,
yes,
or southwestern territories from the United States in the next century?
Yes, it's him. Mm. There's a recent book out, the word, treason is in the title. I can't remember the exact name of the book, but it's about James Wilkinson, who was only 20 years old and was adjutant to Gates at Saratoga. But he had a later military career. He was cashiered at one point, came back. He ended up being a spy for the Spanish. He was simultaneously employed in the American military and as an agent of the Spanish government. He ended up going to Mexico City, where he had some sort of land deal, and he died in Mexico City. He's buried there. But there was another Wilkinson, who was William Wilkinson, that made those wonderful maps for the British. And there's a third Wilkinson, who's my best friend at Albany, who's the biological anthropologist who did the workup on the skeletal remains that we found in 1972. So you got to keep your Wilkinsons straight.
Yes, sir. Okay. I'm a Vermonter, and I would lose my Vermont credibility if I didn't mention the Battle of Hubbardton. Speak on that.
The Battle of
Hubbardton.
Oh, Hubbardton.
The battle, yeah, that nobody's ever heard of.
It turns out that there's a really good report on the Battle of Hubbardton that's unpublished. And it was done by archaeologists who were complying with a requirement, a state and federal requirement, that archaeological work be done ahead of any major construction so that if there are any archaeological resources that are put at risk, we'll know about them. And it turns out to be a terrific report. Not much else has been written about Hubbardton, but it should be. Ackland he was the head of the Grenadiers. He was the commander of the British Grenadier Battalion, was wounded at Hubbardton. And because of that, his wife, Harriet, who was up in Montreal, who had promised to stay away, said, "I'm coming down to the front. I'm going to nurse my husband back to health, and you can't stop me." Nobody stopped Harriet Ackland from doing anything she wanted. She was one of these women who was so gracious and so widely admired. She was the kind of woman who causes men to become unglued in her presence. And the whole British Army thought that she was just the most wonderful of women. Then, of course, he gets wounded again in the second battle, the Battle of Bemis Heights. And she asks for permission to go through the lines to the American side so she can nurse her husband yet again. And Burgoyne allows her to do that. And actually, Dearborn receives her in a boat that comes down the river, takes her back to the hospital, and she accompanies her husband to Albany and nurses him back to health again. Then they get sent back to England, and the dope got himself into a duel because somebody said something disparaging about Americans, and by this time he thought Americans were pretty nice guys. And he said, "Sir, I won't tolerate that." He gets into a duel and he gets killed. And she's left with two little kids.
One more question about terminology. The War of Independence is often called the American Revolution by the British, and yet this battle would seem to have made it genuinely a war because the Spanish and French came in. What do you think would be the significance of the British still calling it a revolution and us calling it a War of Independence?
I've wondered what we call this war for a long time, because sometimes it's called the War of Independence, sometimes it's called the American Revolution, and I've never understood if there's some sort of etiquette about this. But my experience is that the British don't talk about it at all. They don't teach anything about the American this war, whatever you call it. They don't teach it in school over there. They would rather not discuss it. So I've been hoping, this is Oxford Press after all, and one of the reasons I got excited about publishing with Oxford Press, this is my publicist over here, one of the reasons I got excited about doing this was I thought, you know, I think the Brits ought to read this. If it's going to be, if I wrote it like, you know, these two old guys that fought each other in the Po Valley talked about their experiences, they know. A lot of time has gone by. We've been in wars with, on the same side as the British now several times since then. So I should think that they would, at this point, be willing to read a book which treats them, I think, fairly. There were decent people on both sides up at Saratoga. And they became friends during, you see it happening when these officers on both sides sit down and start negotiating the agreement, and they become buddies very quickly. This is just the way men are. There's also one story in there about a couple of Irishmen that brothers that recognize each other during the truce. Well, you read the book, you'll see it.
Last question.
Okay.
How did the Americans handle the deserters, especially the German-speaking ones?
The deserters were taken back to Albany temporarily. Hyde's Connecticut Light Horse was in charge of escorting the prisoners during the course before the surrender. And then after the surrender, the Connecticut Light Horse escorted most of the enlisted men to Virginia. And the other officers were sent east to Boston and eventually exchanged, which is how they got back to England as quickly as they did. A lot of the enlisted men, particularly the Germans, just settled, and you know, their descendants are still here. They became Americans, and a lot of the British did too, but it was more the Germans than the British. The Germans' case is kind of interesting because early in the fighting, they were told, "Do not let yourself get captured by the Americans. do not desert to the American side. They are cannibals. They have learned all these awful practices from these Indians. You know about Indians. So, you know, as far as, that's what the officers were telling the men in the German regiments. Do not allow yourself to be captured. You're a dead man if you do. And it didn't take very long before they found out otherwise, and there was a hemorrhaging of desertion of the British forces, particularly German troops. Some entire units came over, an entire company with, you know, a non-commissioned officer and all the men would come over together once in a while. So there was a lot of desertion as we got closer to the surrender.
Dr. Dean Snow, thank you so much.